I mean, if you look at those pictures from the James Webb Telescope, or forget that. I mean, you take your macro on your phone and look at a flower. To not be moved by that is kind of weird. And that then in education, we don't talk about that is, to me, an indictment of how badly we are doing things. And again, I don't think this will necessarily move everybody. That's not the point. But I think that there is a group of students, there is a group of learners who, if we approach this way, will fall in love with the science, with the math, with the ideas.
I'm Brandon Vaidyanathan, and this is Beauty at Work, a podcast about how beauty shapes our world and the work that we do. In this season, we're looking at beauty in science. This episode is sponsored by Templeton Religion Trust and the Institute for Advanced Catholic Studies at the University of Southern California. More about them later in the show. Well, hello and welcome. My guest today is Dr. Punya Mishra, who's Associate Dean of Scholarship and Innovation and Professor in the Division of Educational Leadership and Innovation in the Mary Lou Fulton Teachers College at Arizona State University. He's internationally recognized for his work in technology integration in teaching, the role of creativity and aesthetics in learning, and the application of design-based approaches to educational innovation. He's received over $7 million in grants, published over 100 articles, edited 3 books. He's an award-winning teacher, an engaging public speaker, an accomplished visual artist and poet, and, like any true Douglas Adams fan, is interested in life, the universe, and everything. Punya, thanks so much for joining us. Such a great pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Brenna. It's a pleasure to be on there, and hopefully I have something to contribute to the conversation that you've been having.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There's lots that I want to ask you about. To start, I mean, you've got a really an exceptionally rich background combining art and science. I mean, it's really rare for someone to straddle engineering and communication and social science, education. Tell us a little bit about your trajectory and what your journey was like, what led you to where you are today.
So, you know, it's one of those cases where hindsight is always 20/20, where it looks like where I ended up was where I was supposed to. But trust me, it was far from that. So, you know, growing up in India, I was interested in science and literature and art and film and like pretty much everything, right? But in India, when you're growing up, if you're good at science, you either go the medical route or you go the engineering route. And I'd always wanted to be a physicist and got convinced by my mom in particular that getting a degree in engineering would not close that door, but at least I would be employable at the end of it. And I've written about it somewhere about my greatest failure, which I call those 4 years of engineering, which basically I think the way it was taught there just hammered this my energy and enthusiasm and passion completely out of me. I mean, I remember my first semester in a quantum mechanics class, I was writing limericks about quantum mechanics. That's the kind of goofball I was. And 4 years of just unending testing and no concern for understanding or for the richness of learning and valuing that, it just sort of killed it for me. And I couldn't wait to get out of that. You know, I had decent grades and all that. It wasn't that. And one of my friends saw a poster for the Industrial Design Center where they had a visual communications program. And I said, okay, if, you know, I grew up watching Carl Sagan and Jacob Bronowski, being very inspired by writers like Stephen G. Gould. So I said, okay, I love science, I love math, I love film and art and literature and design and illusions and cognitives, everything, right? And so maybe this is where I need to be, where I can bring all these pieces together. And what I wrote in that piece actually was that it was amazing that in the May of 88, May of, I'm showing my age here, but in May of 88, I had no idea where I was going, what my identity was. By September of that year, I had found my calling, right? It was like, so nothing had changed in me. The context around me had changed, which allowed for all these goofy stuff that I did to fit under this rubric of design. And at the same time, I started first time working with Max and started programming in HyperCard and realizing that there is something happening with this technology where things can come together in interesting ways. So I ended up getting my PhD, long story short, ended up at Michigan State and now at Arizona State, where I think I pilfer ideas from everywhere, If I do anything creative, I completely say it's just stolen from everywhere else and put together in sort of interesting ways. So yeah, so that's sort of briefly how this,
right?
What?
That's what innovation is, I suppose, right? Building.
Right. You know, it is that sort of this combination of serendipity and sort of putting pieces together in interesting ways. And I think the transformational point was that degree in design, because I still consider myself, I don't call myself an educational researcher, I call myself an educational designer. So my research, I always see it from the point of view of what's its application, how can we help to create better experiences for our learners, for our students. And then there is an art and a craft to it. There is a sort of a creative piece to it. And there is hugely an aesthetic piece to it. I mean, one of the things I don't think in teaching we talk often enough about is like how you craft your curriculum, how you think about the nature of the experience. That is completely an aesthetic domain, right? You can have all the pieces in place, but if those pieces don't add up, you don't really have in what Dewey would call an experience. And so good teaching is about creating those experiences. And those are, at some fundamental level, quite aesthetic in nature, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to talk a little bit more about your own writing on beauty and aesthetics in STEM. Before that, could you tell us then, I mean, in terms of these aesthetic experiences, what role has beauty or aesthetics played in your own education and your own experience in your own work?
I think, I mean, the reason I got interested in science in the first place when I was growing up in Mizoram in India and in Delhi was I remember this moment of watching David Attenborough's Life on Earth and had been reading some Gould and some stuff. I must have been 8th, 9th, 10th grade, and just understanding in a visceral way evolution. And then I couldn't see the world around me without having that lens of evolution. Suddenly, everything around me made sense from that lens. It's like, wow, that butterfly. I mean, I remember this, sitting in the garden with my mom, a bright butterfly would come and land on a flower, and it would always sit with its wings closed, but the dull ones would sit with their wings open. And my question was, is that because, like, evolutionarily, if you're open like this, you're more amenable to being caught because you're bright and shiny or whatever, right? So, I mean, the point is it's not even whether that's a valid question to ask, but it gave me a lens into seeing the world. My dissertation that I did my PhD on was in the periodic system of elements. And to me, I think we do a disservice to chemistry by calling it a periodic table, because it sort of makes it being one rigid thing. If you look at chemists, they have created 400 or 500 different representations. There are spiral ones, three-dimensional ones, because it's a complicated system of elements and complex relationships, which we have sort of essentialized into this one table, which we know is wrong, as every representation has to be. And so it's those sort of this element of the visual, the aesthetic, that were very powerful to me early on. And I think they've been deeply motivating to me even today. And I think, like most of when we talk about science education, we talk about it in such instrumental terms. But you go talk to scientists, they're not doing it for the salary. They're not doing it. And, you know, of course, the money is important. Don't get me wrong. I mean, my dean shouldn't hear this, but, you know, all of that is important. But the reason we do it are always deeper than that. It is this, you know, an urge to understand, to get a lens on the world. Alison Gopnik has this wonderful article, which the title of which I think I wish I had thought of that, but it's called Explanation as Orgasm. And, you know, Oppenheimer has this great quote where it says, you know, sex is for reproduction, but that's not why we usually do it. So Gopnik says that evolutionarily, as the species, we get a kick out of understanding things. And so that explanation, that understanding of seeing the world anew, I think is a very powerful thing. And that's a deeply emotional, aesthetic, personal thing. So I think that's really driven a lot of how I think about education and why I am sort of very critical of many instrumental arguments, you know, for why we should be doing science or STEM or whatever you want to call it, because I think that these are among sort of the greatest creations of the human mind, that we, this little creature on this planet. I mean, if you look at those pictures from the James Webb telescope, or forget that. I mean, you take your macro on your phone and look at a flower. To not be moved by that is kind of weird. And that then in education, we don't talk about that is to me an indictment of how badly we are doing things. And again, I don't think this will necessarily move everybody. That's not the point. But I think that there is a group of students, there is a group of learners who, if we approach this way, will fall in love with the science, with the math, with the ideas. And I think that's always been very important and motivational to me personally.
Yeah. Have you encountered that? Have you encountered students who perhaps may have been put off by, you know, the kind of rote memorization that's usually associated with science, kind of lack of creativity, but then sort of encounters?
Well, I mean, the research on that is pretty clear, right? That we are not doing a good job by our students. You know, a common friend of ours, Mark Girard, I think his dissertation is one of my favorite dissertations of all time, and was one of the first committees I served on when I was at Michigan State. And he did this sort of paired comparison between sort of a very good instrumental teaching of science, you know, and somebody who was doing an aesthetic sort of approach to science. So he would, like, this teacher would take the kids out and they would lie down on the ground and would be like, there is an ocean of air. And this is the, I mean, so starting to see. And so there is some evidence to show that in those kinds of classrooms, kids were talking a lot more about science outside of the class. You know, I don't know how old your kids are, but my kids are older now. But the standard conversation after every day of school was, what happened in school today? The answer would be nothing.
Yeah. It's the same here.
Right. So that is so depressing. It's like, this is where your minds are supposed to be blown, right? Anecdotally, I used to have this project in Chicago Public Schools working with STEM educators there. And in order to bring this aesthetic element into teaching, we started this thing called the wow, or the world of wonder moment. And so I would share some of my own. So I had one which was like, we were cooking some lentils at home and I saw this weird soccer ball pattern. And I started investigating how that happened. And I'm flying back from Austin at a conference and I see these cloud trains, which are these straight rows of clouds. And those are sort of connected by how heat moves and, you know, so on. And it's like, how cool is that? That something that's happening in my kitchen, you know, is also happening at the level of, you know, like geology or, you know, at the planet or whatever. And we would ask teachers to come up with this and say, find out why, what is puzzling about this? And so they would start sharing stories. And you couldn't go online and find something. You'd have to find something. That I was driving the other day and I had this question: where does all the sewage from Chicago go? And then you start finding out that that sewage actually led to Chicago being have to be jackhammered up because it was flowing back. I mean, it's hilarious how many things you can learn if you bring the sense of wonder. Now, one of the teachers in my class, I remember the first day she came in and she talked about how happy she was to be in this program, because she was working with these four children who were completely at risk of falling through because of violence in the community around or whatever. And I remember putting my head down and saying, this is way above our pay grade. Like, nothing we do in this classroom can fix that or address that. 2 months later, she takes the world of wonder and creates a wall of wonder in her classroom where students can start posting questions. And she talks about how one of these kids was like so thrilled that his question got selected and then everybody collectively did research on it. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like today we are humans after all. These things move us, right? I mean, you know, you look at the night sky, you look at the Grand Canyon, these things move us. And yes, is it something that has to be inculcated and encouraged? Absolutely. The beauty of a mathematical proof is not accessible to everybody unless and until you have been inculcated enough. So you are part of the aesthetic growth and development is developing this inner gyroscope. I mean, that's where sort of mentorship comes in. That's where understanding the rules of the game come in. That's where understanding the boundaries of the discipline come in and the kinds of ideas and, you know, and then that's when you start really getting it. But I think it can start very early with very simple things. I mean, I used to do this with my kids where trying to explain to them the idea of mathematical functions. And we would do it by my walking across the carpet at, you know, or my son and I walking, you know, oh, he's going twice as fast as me. That's x equals 2x. And then you start doing things like modulo, and then it becomes you're limping as you walk because you're bouncing. It's just hilarious, right? But that's a way of accessing math, which is real. And that it opens up the world to you in ways. And I think that to me is the best part of the aesthetic experience, is this opening up of the world and this continuous sort of regeneration that it never ends, because you know, you scratch that itch and you're going to have another one. You want another question, you want another question.
Right. It's inexhaustible. Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. You're listening to Beauty at Work. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Templeton Religion Trust as part of a grant on the aesthetic dimensions of science. Templeton Religion Trust supports projects as well as storytelling related to projects that seek to enrich the conversation about religion. To learn more about them, visit templetonreligiontrust.org. This episode is also sponsored by the Institute for Advanced Catholic Studies, a global research center located at the University of Southern California. IACS works to create dialogue, spark ideas, and sustain academic research on Catholic thought, creative imagination, and lived experience. Learn more at iacs.usc.edu. If you're enjoying the show so far, please subscribe to our podcast and take a moment to leave us a review. Tell us about why teachers should care about beauty in science education. I mean, that's something you've written about. And why is it important in particular for teachers?
I think I've addressed a couple of the points, but I think just to reiterate, I think science is an incredibly human activity. And there are many elements that go into that sort of aesthetic experience, right? So one is this curiosity, this questioning, this sense of awe, this sort of anticipation of understanding. I think that is how science or any kind of inquiry begins. If we start by giving students the answers, you know, which is what we do, right? We scaffold like this is what Newton's first law is and whatever. It just becomes a set of rote things that you want to learn. There is none of that appreciative inquiry about the world.
Yeah, if you don't have a question, the answer seems pointless, right? I mean, just without evoking a question, yeah.
Right, exactly, right. So one of the things that one of our professors here does, she has sort of a curriculum that she has developed. And she's an astrophysicist who got really interested in teaching. But her approach is like, you give students, they have to come up with a question. They have to go to original sources to come up with, and here's the best part, more questions. So she doesn't want them to answer that because there is no answers. You know, you ask a question, the chances are the research in the field still is figuring stuff out. And so you have to come back with three more questions. And that's how the curriculum goes. And I thought that was so amazing. The second piece to me is why this it's important for science educators or all educators is the process. There is an element of sort of detective storytelling, of working with and against nature or the world to figure it out. Like if you think of a really cool experiment, it actually cheats nature in some ways to reveal its secrets. And so that's exciting. I mean, that's solving puzzles and, you know, working together. And that's, I think that process is where you start inculcating some of the foundational ways of looking at the world that discipline has. Like, I mean, there's a reason that the word discipline is used. Like, it's not in the military sense of discipline, but it is a discipline. It is a structured, again, it's open. People can question it, all of that. But at least in a given field, at a given moment, there are certain ways that we do things. And I think inculcating that is through that process. And then finally, if you get the answer, there is this, aha, that's that explanation is orgasm bit, right? I mean, it's like, wow. And I mean, I remember reading Feynman when I was young, and there's this one diagram he has from Newton's textbook. And it's like the simplest geometry thing, but I couldn't understand it. I don't know why, my mind just blocked. And then suddenly I remember the sleeping at night and I woke up, like lying in bed, and I just sat up like, shit, I get Kepler's laws. You know, and did I discover it? No. This guy had done it hundreds of years ago. But that moment was real to me, truthfully, right? So I think it's the sense of like, I know something about the world that is so cool, that I think is super powerful. And now you see what happens is that you end up back with more questions. You know, and so to me, in some ways, this model of aesthetic learning maps the scientific sort of method in some way, but I think has a lot of pedagogical potential because you're starting with curiosities, you're starting with, and then develop techniques to address that question. Like, what's a fair question in this, right? I mean, one of the things that I used to do with my teachers is like back up the envelope calculations. It's like, how much poop is generated by humans every day in cubic foot? how do you even start? Like, do you know the density of poop? No, we don't. Okay, can we make some ballpark guesses? It's a hilarious question, but you can go down some really interesting, weird math sidelines. But it's genuine in the sense you don't, but you have to make estimates and guesses. And so I think, so to me, that is why to be human is to be a scientist, is to be a writer, is to be a painter, you know, is to be an artist, a musician. And I think that if we don't include these, we are doing a disservice to our kids.
I think that's really, really important to certainly, I mean, I've been trying to think, you know, it's just because, you know, I teach as well. And I was just with my department yesterday and we were trying to think through some of the challenges that we're facing with students who, in whom it's very difficult to generate that sense of wonder, the sense of curiosity. And we're trying to think through, like, are there emotional obstacles to learning? Are there emotional prerequisites for learning, right? So what does it take to become curious? Because we typically think about, okay, here's what I want to, these are my goals for this course. This is what I want them to know at the end of the course. And then we sort of figure out a structure by which we will pace that dissemination of content. But we aren't really paying attention to the emotional journey and to the process of how questions emerge and what does it take to create those questions. So I think, yeah, I think what you're saying is really, really vital, you know, for us, I think, in science education and beyond.
Yeah, I think the thing here is that it's going to be different for each person. Like what worked for me wouldn't necessarily work for someone else, right? And so one of the things that I try to do in like these programs that I had, particularly with working teachers in the master's program, is multiple things. Because something's going to click for somebody, something's going to click for somebody else, right? And so the World of Wonder thing was 15 minutes in the morning. That's it. But for some people, it sparked a thing. And then others are like, oh, you could do a Wall of Wonder. Okay, I'm going to try this in my classroom. And they took it in a different direction. It's fine, right? But the fact that after a long time, each of them became a learner. Because we forced them to. We said, you have to come up with something. You have to look at the world around you and come up with a question and then investigate it and come and report what you learned. And so it would be like super interesting, like the things that would emerge from things, like just that open-endedness, plus having 15 minutes, no more than that. In like the design class I teach, I share some examples of good and bad design from the world that I've taken pictures of over the years. Things like doors with user manuals saying push or pull. It's like, you know, who reads a user manual, A, and B, why should a door have one? And I make them go and take pictures and share. And they will, to a person, talk about how their relationship to the built world suddenly changes once they put that design lens on. And they start seeing it everywhere. They start seeing it in parking lots. They start seeing it in websites and processes for completing menus. They see it in water faucets. The number of examples we get from bathrooms and kitchens is amazing.
Yeah.
You know, but that's the lens, right? I mean, that's a way of looking at the world as being built, and sometimes built well, sometimes built badly. And we just don't pay attention to it. So I think that's one of the biggest things of the aesthetic thing is this idea of attention and noticing. It gives you chances to notice and pay attention to things in the fullness of it. And, you know, Csikszentmihalyi talks about this distinction between perception and recognition. I think that very often what we do in school, we force this idea of recognition. We label thing a chair. The moment you see it as a chair, you don't see it for its heft, its weight, its texture, the way it leans back when you sit on it, how it feels. It's now a chair. But the moment what a designer does is sees the chair for all of these, he doesn't recognize, he sort of withholds recognition or has techniques to withhold recognition. And I think a lot of time what we do in education is that our goals become, by the end of the semester, by the end of the year, my students should be able to do the following, which you think is shorthand for they should be able to recognize. But curiosity and openness in some way demands that we focus on perception, right? So there's this tension here. You want those disciplinary lenses to understand the world. At the same time, you want to be open up for the world to push back on these lenses and push back on your thinking. And that's a fascinating tension educationally, right?
Is there a way in which you have to inhabit a discipline first before you can question it or before?
But I think it can be done in authentic ways, in small ways. Right? So, you know, I had this whole argument with one of my friends who's a mathematician, and he was pushing back against some of these discussions about like we all math needs to be authentic and we are spending too much time on la-di-da. And he says, oh, no, this is powerful. This is great, blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know something, I mean, it depends on how you define authentic. If you define authentic as being what, you know, balancing your checkbook and just leave it at that, then that's a problem. But if you want to be authentic to the lived experience of mathematicians, then the aesthetic has to come into the picture, right? And so I think it depends on how you talk about the like, what is it that historians care about or economists care about? There is an aesthetic element to that. There's no doubt.
You've written also about the role of beauty in coding and even in learning to code. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so that was a project I had done with a former student of mine who was interested in this, and I sort of pulled in the aesthetic component into it, and we ended up writing about that. So personally, like, you know, when I first started, I mean, I'm dating myself seriously here. So programming, when I first started doing it in Bits Pilani, was with punch cards, literally. And that was like, I was least interested in it. Then we got like, you know, Pascal and Turbo Pascal on the PCs, didn't like it. I go to IDC and then I start working on the Mac and I discover this thing called HyperCard. And I was off to the races and running, because it changed the way we thought about code. And then when I finally read up about it, you know, there's this classic textbook, Donald Knuth's The Art of Computer Programming. And the way he talks about coding, and that was sort of the Bible for the longest time, is that you take a problem, you break it up into subsets and subsets. You don't write a line of code till you have broken the problem down completely through this sort of flowchart kind of a thing. And then you start writing the code. I clearly did not fit that. And there is some research to show that women in particular got pushed out of computer science because they didn't code that way. That didn't come naturally to them. Sherry Turkle has written about it. There's another group of programmers who do what Sherry Turkle calls bricolage. They write some code, the code doesn't work, then they write a little piece there, a little piece there. They have vaguely some idea about where this is going to end up. And the guy who created HyperCard, Bill Atkinson, that's how he talks about coding. And so to me, that's an aesthetic decision, you know, of style, of how we approach the problem. Neither is wrong. And there's this book called Beautiful Code, where they talk about ugly code and beautiful code and, you know, so on. And so I think that if we bring that sort of, there is a sort of an engineering aesthetic, which I think is important. I think coding takes it to the next level, that can I do the most with the least? Like, I can use the least number of bits in order to do X. And I often joke that the Y2K problem was caused by that. Because I remember when I was in my computer science, you know, when I was doing this in my undergrad, at one point, there's this one guy who was our guru, you know, who I would go to for like coding advice. And he looked at my code and said, see, you coded the date using like 4 digits, 1964. You don't need that. You just need 64. And that was a matter of pride, because it's like with least amount of computing power we can get. Except sitting in like 1984, we were not thinking 85 or 86. We were not thinking that the year 2000 would happen. You know, so I always joke that Y2K was sort of a consequence of the engineering aesthetic of doing more with less, you know, because like that shows really cool. But I think that's a bit of an exaggeration, but you get the point. And so I think that again, in coding, if we bring that element in early on, like, why is a certain solution more elegant or more parsimonious or more beautiful? I think it might appeal to certain people. I mean, I know my daughter, when she was in high school, I told her, take a programming class just because you should know something about what it is. Because one day she's like, I'm never doing this. I'm like, why? Like, it's, Papa, it's all boys and they are stupid and they crack stupid jokes. They have no whatever. And the teacher, the first thing the teacher does is shows us a video of somebody whacking a computer and says, this is how you're going to feel the rest of the semester. And then people are surprised that certain kids don't go toward computer science. That my daughter now has a degree in business analytics and writes code for a living. I mean, she's writing code for me to clean up Zoom transcripts. Right? But in high school, it was just stomped out of her. She just didn't go. She's like, I'm not going to the classroom. It's a stupid, you know, male sort of whatever, stupid jokes, and the teacher is no better. Right? And so I think that we are doing a disservice to the field. We are doing a disservice to the people who can succeed at that in ways. She has a very good visual sense, so she loves representing data and so on. That could have been nurtured much early on.
Yeah, I mean, these are really fascinating points, right? Because there's aesthetic cultures, right? And they could be driven by gender, and, you know, there could be a particular kind of male boys club kind of culture that has certain tastes for what kinds of jokes. I mean, those are all, jokes are also aesthetic in nature. And so there's that aspect. And then you talked also about elegance and the heuristic aspect of beauty, right? Which people are arguing in theoretical physics that the idea that beautiful math is a guide to truth is misleading. And, you know, so yeah, say a little bit more about that. I mean, are there ways in which you see aesthetics as a...
Yeah, so if I can share one of my favorite examples of this, right? So there is this whole, now the multiverse has become big, right? Because of Marvel and all of that. But back in the day, like this I'm talking about 20 years ago or so, when I was reading, there was this sort of, these two physicists sort of arguing against each other about the multiverse hypothesis. And both of them used the same rationale. Both of them said, you know, there is only one universe. That's the simplest solution. And the other one was like, nope, the simplest solution is the fact that there are multiple universes. And I think I was talking to one of my grad students. I said, the point is not whether simplicity as is a determinant of what the reality of the world is, but that it is a rhetorical move in some ways, that both of them are using an aesthetic argument in a space where they don't have enough data to go one way or the other. They're using the same move, but it is an aesthetic move, you know, and that to me is what is interesting, is that scientists do use that. But guess what? There are times when the world comes and slaps you in the face and says, it's not the way you thought it was. And then you go for the next simpler hypothesis, you know, which is more complex than the simplest one, you know, and so on. So I think that, so there is this sort of tension there between, I think, being overly reliant on aesthetic criteria. But I think that's the beauty of science, is at the end of the day, you will have to be driven by what your data say. You know, you might want the, from sort of a Pythagorean perspective, for all the orbits, you know, of the planets to be perfect circles. Yeah, I get the aesthetic value of that. But guess what? That's not how it is. And then you think of the next best thing. You say, oh, it's the amount of area that they cover in a given amount of time still stays the same. And that's so cool. You know, so I think there's a like a lovely tension there where that becomes a tool in your toolkit, but one that at some level you need to be fundamentally suspicious of, you know? And I think that it plays out differently in different fields. And you and I have talked a little bit about that, that I think that if you talk to biologists or ecologists, they rely much less on things like parsimony because they're very suspicious of it, because their field is littered with ideas which were very parsimonious, but didn't go very far, or the exceptions found exceptions and so on, right? So there is that tension that you see. But I think that's it's a very productive tension. But at the end of the day, from an educator's point of view, the fact that scientists use these heuristics, that it is meaningful for them, that they can use these to communicate ideas with each other, that they become productive ways of addressing a problem of starting with the simplest or the most parsimonious or whatever, become tools that students need to know as well. Yeah. Right. So I think from an educational point of view, I think it has value that way too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. You have to get a sense of what counts as a good explanation and a taste for it too. Right. And so you have to cultivate that without becoming a source of bias. You've also developed a framework to help us think about the role of aesthetics in STEM. Could you tell us about your model that you developed?
Again, not to claim that this is in any way original. It builds on work done by a whole host of people who we have cited in the paper and I won't list. But I think I, you know, in the previous part of the conversation, I talked about this thing of sort of the curiosity and wonderment, you know, and then that's what leads to sort of you're asking these questions and the process, the journey that we go through. And the journey in and of itself is exciting because, you know, you just have to read The Double Helix or something like that to just know how exciting that process is of discovery and of just chasing, of not even knowing you're going to succeed or not, right? And so there is this sort of a change in perception. So, and then the third is, of course, what, so we call this, you know, in our model, we call it the wonderment, which has sort of appreciation and curiosity. Then the next step we call the journey, which is sort of the process that we follow, which is determined by your discipline and the kinds of phenomena you're interested in, and sort of changes in perception and a socialization into that field. I think that's an important piece. And then finally, we call this the fulfillment, which is this sense of accomplishment that you have. And, you know, various people talk about it in spiritual terms. People talk about it as knowing the mind of God, even though they might not be, they might be atheist or agnostic in that regard. But the sense of that you are touching something deeper, that's, that you are learning something about how the world functions is very powerful. And then, and the nice thing I think about our, this, the way we have framed it is that at the end of that, it's not over, because what you have essentially done, you have amped up your appreciation and your curiosity, because now you have more questions. You have, you know, an appreciation of this thing in a deeper and more fundamental way. And I think so this becomes this sort of self-fulfilling virtuous cycle, which is why we, you know, once you get on the treadmill, there's no getting off of it, because it's more and more fun, right? To go deeper or, you know, broader or whatever the right word is in that context, right? So I think that's how we sort of think about sort of the aesthetic experience. And what we found is in most of the literature, it was either focused on a sense of awe, a sense of sublime, you know, which was this sort of appreciation and curiosity. Some people would talk about the energy and the passion and the socialization and the importance of that, you know, and others would talk about aesthetic in terms of this sense of aha and of touching the mind of God or whatever you might want to call it. I think what our frame does is sort of pulls it together into one sort of piece. And recently, for a series I do, I was talking with Jonathan Schooler, and he talked about this sort of two different kinds of curiosity. And I think that, so there is this one curiosity, which is, I didn't know about this, and this research is actually quite interesting, because I'd always taken curiosity to be a positive virtue, right? Yeah. That's what, you know, humans are curious, we are curious, blah, blah, blah. But he talks about that the research shows that there are sort of two kinds of. So one is sort of a deprivation curiosity and one is a generative curiosity. The deprivation curiosity finds a gap in knowledge and wants to paper it up. Like just fill it up, like, you know, and then move on. Like I've solved that problem, move on. While the generative one always sees it like, oh, I'm going to just have more questions and I have got more questions. And what the research and the psychological, social psychological research is showing that people who have the first kind are usually the ones who are spreading a lot of fake news, who sort of buy into simplistic ideas of how the world works, and they have an all-encompassing theory. And now that can be used to explain everything, while the ones who are the genuinely, you know, the generative curious. And I think that this fits in with that generative curious mindset. And the other piece I like about our model is that you can start at the personal and individual level in terms of appreciation and curiosity. But I think what was, when we discussed this building this up, one of the things was that we know that humans are social, science is a social enterprise. And, you know, when you first get into science, when you have the right teacher, or you get the right books, or you read the right things, you are being socialized into a way of thinking about the world. And that element of science, I think, is often not recognized as much. And so I think, like, the, if you look at the scientific method and the, what, you know, in the textbooks or whatever, but science really kicks off after print comes into being. And I think there is a reason for that, because ideas could then be put down that could be interrogated, could be shared. And so I think that element of the role of print technology in instantiating science as we know it today has been I mean, people have talked about it, don't get me wrong, but has not been emphasized as much. And so in our model, we wanted to be sure that that aspect of that journey of that inculcation into a way of looking at the world, what is of value, what are the methods that we use to do it, what are some of the heuristics that we use, why are certain techniques better than others, becomes an important part of that process as well. Because, you know, that developing that gyroscope doesn't come necessarily naturally, right? Donald Shawn, you know, he wrote a lot about design and Dewey and all that. So one of the things he talks about, which I found was like amazing when I read it, he said, like, you know, I'd have students bring artifacts to class, and part of my job is to help them develop their gyroscope, their design gyroscope. And I was like, that's awfully arrogant of you. And the question to the person interviewing asked him that, like, do you really think you have a better? He says, yes, I do. I have been doing this for a long time and I've developed it. Doesn't mean I'm always right, but that I have a role to play in helping the next generation of designers or architects or scientists or whatever it may be develop that. And I thought that was a very explicit accounting of what happens often over beer and over chats in labs and discussions in around coffee or, you know, or in classrooms and so on, right? And so one of the things I try to do in my work with grad students is actually be very explicit about it. Because many of these things are even hidden to me unless we start thinking and talking about it.
Yeah. That sense of like what counts as a, you know, like a good explanation or, you know, I mean, that's not obvious right up front, right? I mean, what is elegant to an expert may not be to a novice, right? And so cultivating that is crucial. I suppose the final thing I have in mind to ask you is why the public should care about all this, about the role of aesthetics and science. I mean, do you think that an argument needs to be made for why, you know, whether that can help build, you know, more trust in science and in scientists, and whether it has any potential for non-scientists to learn to be able to learn from this sort of beauty of insight or understanding that you were talking about, or even that sense of awe that is to be found in science? Can that be of value outside of science?
Well, I mean, when you sent me this question, my first response, my notes here is like, not so sure of that. And that I think comes from more of a pessimism of the world around us right now than I think if you'd have asked me this question like 2 years ago, I would have started very differently. But let me put on my 2 years ago hat. You know what I'm talking about, which is like
and the kind just of science denial.
With the polarization, with the information bubbles that we live in and all of that, right? It's become so. I mean, there are a range of reasons one would make the case for why that's important for public to know. I mean, one that I talked about is I really do think that these are among the greatest creations of the human mind. A great novel, a great movie, a great piece of music, a cathedral, whatever it may be. I mean, we value them for their intrinsic value, right? For what they bring to our lives. So forget all the material things that science does. I think science and technology do a lot for us materially, good and bad or whatever. But there is a beauty and a sense of awe and, you know, power in just the ideas themselves. I think that need to be more widely shared. I think there is a human aspect to doing of science where I think much of the rhetoric around science has become like, oh, either it's like, you know, science has the answer to everything or scientists don't have a clue. I mean, you get these polarized kind of things. And I think this makes it a much more human thing. It makes it a thing that we humans do and inherently fallible, but also brutally honest with itself about its ideas. It processes. I mean, you know, there was this recent thing came out that most probably the billions that have been spent on Alzheimer's research might have been based on data that was faked or unreliable. That study was done 10 or 15 years ago. But the point is, in the grand scheme of things, somebody, a grad student, went back and questioned that data. To me, that's sort of the power of science. And I think that's an aspect of science that doesn't get talked about. But that is also, there is that aesthetic core belief in that we can get at some kind of an understanding. You know, there is no real basis for that. We don't know whether we ever will, but that drives it. And I think so. It's elements like that that I think that are important for the public at large to engage with. But again, I'm also very aware that the voices that scientists have are not the most powerful ones in this space, that political or other social, other factors get in, you know, they complicate stories. And then when the human side of science and a fallibility or something comes up, you automatically deny the whole enterprise, which I think is, you know, very problematic in and of itself, right?
Yeah, yeah. This is why one of the things we're wondering about is whether it's perhaps not so much the beauty of scientific facts, which can always be filtered through various interpretations, but maybe the beauty of the scientific process or the ability to encounter, you know, an experience where you can change your mind and find it pleasurable, right? I mean, that's sort of to be surprised. Whether that could be, I don't know, through citizen science or whether some other method, like, is there a way to cultivate that kind of aesthetic disposition more broadly? I mean, science is, I think, unique in its ability to cultivate that, but I don't know what it might take to make that more accessible, you know, to people who otherwise might be locked into their own ways of, as you were talking about, that the negative kind of curiosity, right? So how might one move from that type of curiosity to the generative kind? That might be the kind of question, I suppose.
Yeah, it's tricky, right? I mean, you know, the sort of idea that you can withhold judgment, it's not easy to do. And, you know, and the best of scientists fall for it, right? I mean, they form an idea and they stick with it longer than they should. But that's where I think the collective becomes the powerful thing. This idea of peer review, the idea that one has to put one's data out there and then people can query it. I mean, to me, that's what makes science science, is these sociological aspects around it than just the individual.
Yeah, oh, that's great. Pania, this has been really fascinating. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me. And
oh, thank you.
For those who want to follow your work, we've got your website. That is punyamishra.com, PunyaMishra.com. People can follow you on Twitter at punyamishra. Anything else you'd like to add to our conversation? Any other thoughts that come to mind? Anything that I missed in regard to these issues?
No, I think we covered a lot of ground. And I always joke when I listen to myself afterwards that I speak way too fast.
Well, same here.
But that's a function of that. I just get excited
same
about
here,
ideas.
Yeah.
But I do appreciate and thank you very much for inviting me, because it got me to go back and rethink some of these things that I have not, you know, we published that framework a few years back. And these ideas are always in my mind, but, you know, work takes me in different directions. So it was actually a lot of fun to go back and think about this and have this conversation with you.
Awesome. I'm glad. Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of Beauty at Work. Please be sure to check out our show notes for more resources from our guest. And if you like this episode, please be sure to share it with your friends. And please leave us an honest review. We'd love to hear what you think, and it helps to get the word out about our show. Music for the show was provided by Venkat Subramaniam, and the podcast was edited by Dave Visaya from Podcast Engineers. And thanks again to our two sponsors, Templeton Religion Trust and the Institute for Advanced Catholic Studies at the University of Southern California. To learn more about our research project on beauty and science, visit wellbeingandscience.com. To learn more about our broader project on beauty at work, visit beautyatwork.net. Thanks again, and see you next time.